right. Welcome back, everybody. Here we are at long last, Dom, talking some more Survivor 44. How have you been?
I've been good, and I'm glad to be back. They said it would never happen. The haters and the doubters, I suppose, they said we were one and done this season. You know, we weren't coming back. But at long last, we have finally dragged ourselves back in here. And not just out of spite. I actually was genuinely keen to come in here and put a finishing touch on this season, even though, you know, our coverage of it has been more thin than it ever has been.
When was the first one that we did? An embarrassing question to ask.
I think it was around the merge time, and a lot of that was less talking about the events of the season thus far or what might be to come, and more just kvetching about the general direction of Survivor as manifested in this season, which there was definitely some of that was vindicated by the way the rest of the season played out. But I was actually a lot more high on the season coming out of it after the finale than I was at any point leading up to it. And I think this is a season which actually will hold up quite well for people who are watching it just in an afternoon binge as opposed to week by week in real time, and also maybe on a rewatch, which I don't imagine I'm going to be taking a quiet afternoon to rewatch the season anytime soon. But if I did, I think I would like what I saw a lot more than I did where I was just like checking in but mostly checked out week by week.
You have successfully jogged my memory on the Kvetch Fest that we had right around merge time, and the one thing I definitely remember coming up along those lines, and I feel like this is the place to kind of dive in and check on where you are currently standing on this issue. I was, at whatever point that was, about halfway through the season, already quite a big Jam Jam fan, and I believe it is the case. In fact, I'm sure it's the case, Dom, because it blew me away to hear you say that you were not seeming to be loving Jam Jam as much as, at least on the surface, in our kind of Twitter bubble, it seemed like the vast majority of people were. Did you come around on Jam Jam and that's why you ended up enjoying the season more? Or where, what kind of sparked that shift in your view of it?
Well, I stand by what I said, which was, as a character, I wasn't as drawn in by him as a lot of people were. But despite that, I still really found this a satisfying and compelling ending, and the right ending as well. So even though I was a big Carolyn stan as a character, I think she is an all-time unique character who I may be the number one favorite to return if and when they get around to actually bringing players back from this era. Despite all of that, I think that this was the right outcome, both in terms of like what we saw and the storytelling, and the right one for the season. I think to have someone like Jam Jam win in a number of different ways is going to be great for modern Survivor. So yeah, you'd love to see it. And I didn't especially warm to Carson either as like that other third of the Tika 3. But despite my mixed reactions across the board there, I found the Tika 3 storyline really compelling. And I think this is what this season has got right that the other seasons we've had in the 40s so far have not, which is a lot of them, they had these characters who they did a great job of bigging up and telling their stories, and we were really invested in them, only for them to suffer this amazing downfall out of the blue. And those by themselves made for fantastic Survivor episodes. But when all was said and done and you're picking up the pieces, it's kind of tough to know where to go from there. And you're left scratching your head wondering why we should care about the people who were left at that point. So 41, of course, you had like Evie and Ricard and Shan and like a bunch of these big characters. And then once they all just get massacred successively, it's like, well, they never really bothered to tell the story of Erica. And I think would have had a hard job even if they tried to tell that properly. 42 was a little more even in that regard. I think they did an okay job. But then 43, of course, I was like, yeah, we have Cody and Jesse and Carla and Cassidy, Gable, Owen, all there at the end. And when they tried to, at the last minute, like, sell us on the whole Ali Gable thing, I wasn't buying it then. I'm not buying it now. So that one will always stick in my craw. I think 44, though, this was the story of the Tika 3. By the end, we were all rooting for one of the Tika 3 to take it down. And there have been some, like, heated debates after the fact over which of them it should have been. But it seemed like the audience and the cast themselves and also production were in broad agreement that, like, okay, this is the story of the Tika 3. How can we tell that well? They told it well. And so I think the season worked and felt coherent in a way that the others have not so far.
I think I am on just about as diametrically opposite of a page as you as one could conceivably draw up, where I absolutely see what you're saying and understand why you or anyone might feel that way about, you know, it seems for the first however many days, like these are going to be the main characters, the big winner contenders, the people the audience is supposed to be caring about, and then the rug just gets pulled out. I definitely get why that would be frustrating or underwhelming or whatever, especially as things pertain to someone like Erica winning the game and getting pretty grotesquely under-edited, bearing that result in mind. For me, as much as I really, really enjoyed everything that we got out of this Tika 3, I, over the first three seasons of the new era, thought that that element of anyone is on the table to get clipped at any time was like one of the best things the show had going for it, and almost going the opposite direction as they had for the first 20 years of Survivor as things pertain to like making sure the winner for the most part would like stand out from the crowd and every casual in America would be rooting for them at Final Tribal Council and have a very clear understanding of why they won. This time around, even though, again, I was very happy to see the way that the game was progressing and the, I'm comfortable calling it kind of like domination by the Tika 3 over the course of this season. I just pulled up the Wikipedia here for Survivor 44, and I think I probably have to go back as far as Matthew, who left with the shoulder injury, to go to a person being eliminated that I thought had a real chance of winning the game. Like, I, again, 43 in particular, but each season of the new era to this point hit me with a finale that, if you had asked me through the first even like 8 or 9 episodes, would have been one of the outcomes I thought were far less likely than certain other ones along the way. And I think, you know, had we been doing podcasts over the course of 44, to a probably super annoying extent, I would have been tripping over myself every single week to say, this is what I think we're looking at. But, you know, every other time I've thought that for the entire duration of the new era, we've gotten everything wrong about how, like, the end game was ultimately going to shape up. But I would say, and I'm happy to grant that I'm probably being very results oriented here, I don't know that there would have been virtually any week that we could have come in here and been talking in any terms other than, this is very obviously the story of the Tika 3, and with the caveat that, of course, you know, we're in the new era, and winners can come out of nowhere and be hiding in plain sight, and whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
I just had a very difficult time talking myself into, like, the Brandons and Frannies and Dannys of the world being anything other than like the obvious big targets that are going to get taken out right around when they got taken out, and the Laurens and Heidis and Jamies being like the people who go far but are not really in there with a chance to win at the end.
I totally see what you mean, and this season it felt like the Frannies and the Dannys of the world were made to be like the big targets who you don't actually believe in your heart of hearts could make it to the end and win because you know they're going to get clipped.
Exactly.
Right around when they did get clipped. In a way that I actually talked myself into, yeah, maybe Evie's going to win the season. Maybe Ricard's going to win the season, and ended up getting bamboozled week after week, which I think was, that was not just a reflection on them editing Erica poorly, but also on them editing each of those people well. And you could argue that maybe that's zero sum to some extent. And like, if you want to have the Evies and the Shans and the Ricards, and Shan being the person who I think we said, oh yeah, Shan's like 85% to win the season or what have you, maybe that has to come at the expense of the others, but that's that, we can table that debate for now. Yeah, this season it very much felt like, okay, yeah, Franny or Danny or whoever is the big obstacle that is currently in the Tika 3's way, but you know it's going to get knocked down eventually. That is definitely true. What redeems that to some extent for me is, when we talk about the Tika 3, it did very much feel like the Tika 3, and any one of them could be in with a serious shot of winning, even through the finale, where if you had said to me any of Carolyn, Jam Jam, or Carson is going to win the season, I could understand that and believe you and think, okay, we've seen enough material to justify that, even though I think that given the pairing that we ended up having, Carolyn losing and even getting zero votes is actually like, I get it, and I'm kind of baffled that people are baffled about it, and I think Jam Jam winning in that way is the right outcome, whatever that means. But it did feel like a much more equal partnership than, honestly, any of even some of the more iconic partnerships we've had in the past, right? Even like the iconic duos or trios, very clearly it was, okay, yeah, if they make it to the end, this person's going to win. No one else is even in with a shot. Whereas this time it did actually feel like a much more competitive outcome.
Yeah, I think you could find like a Dom and Wendell, to use an extreme example of, okay, this is sincerely pretty close to a coin flip. And I'm with you there. I certainly went into the finale very prepared for any of the Tika 3 to win, although I do believe I'd have to pull up the exact chat with great friend of the podcast, AJ Van Gilder. But on finale morning or whatever, we were just talking through like our win equity projections, as we do, and I believe I had Carson very low compared to the other two, but I would not have been surprised by any means to see him win, and certainly not to see Carolyn win either. It probably wasn't until at least halfway through the finale that I started feeling like, okay, this really seems like it's pointing towards Jam Jam. Were you at Final Tribal Council still thinking it could go either way?
Yeah, I almost allowed myself a glimmer of, not hope necessarily, but curiosity that, is this Heidi going on some amazing Underwoodian run at the 11th hour here? And I think it makes sense. There'll be a lot to say about the Tika 3. I think it does make sense to start with Heidi here, because she did as good as possible a job, I think, of instilling some doubt in the first, hour or so of this finale. And then I think kind of fumbled the ball at Final Tribal and removed all of that doubt from the equation. But for the first half of that night, I was thinking, wow, maybe Heidi's actually going to flip this around and pull this off. But she put together this Underwood-esque start after having actually been in the game for the prior 20-something days with all of the baggage that came with that. And I think that until that point, she was playing a game that was perceived, correctly or incorrectly, as quite passive and avoiding risks and just trying to go with the flow and manage her threat level, but almost doing that well enough that she was not seen as a threat of any sort by the time she made it to that point. And so there have definitely been finales where we come in here saying, yeah, if this person who is on the outs right now rattles off the last two immunities, they win the game. And so it's a high stakes outcome for them, but that's probably not going to happen. And just statistically, and also based on what we've seen from the editing, can kind of deduce that is not actually going to come to pass. With Heidi, it seemed like even if she won her way to the end, she would not actually win at the end. But she did a good job of like keeping us on our toes for a little bit.
So were it not for the last few seasons where many winners came, for, at least from my perspective, very much out of the blue till the like super end game. And like in the case of Gabler in particular, which was the most recent Final Tribal Council I'd watched, at no point in that entire season, from the day I first learned about the cast until watching every single episode, the very first second that I opened my mind to the possibility that Gabler had any chance of winning was when Jeff read the second jury vote for him. That is the first time that I was open to the prospect of that being a thing. And because of that, I did have the glimmer of hope in the back of my mind during Final Tribal Council. Not necessarily that I was like rooting for Heidi, but I did allow myself to believe that maybe this is another one along similar lines, and that would be consistent with pretty much everything else we've seen in the new era, where the winner really is like not one of the main characters for the first at least half of the season. So I did like having the ability to like suspend disbelief after, plural decades of them giving me no real reason to be able to do so. And I will say, not that I was rooting against Heidi by any stretch, but I was very much rooting for Jam Jam when all of that was going on in the moment. But let me ask you, Dom, what would you have had Heidi do differently at Final Tribal Council? Because I think you said she fumbled the bag there. I thought, personally, she took maybe an overly like aggressive or enthusiastic line, and I don't mean either of those in like a negative way, but it like I thought she was taking kind of an extreme approach. I'm using all these words that have like negative connotations that I don't mean to imply as things pertain to Heidi.
But
what I mean is I feel like Heidi recognized I've got to go all out here at Final Tribal Council, and they're either going to respect it or they're not. It seems like you looked at that Final Tribal Council performance and came away with a much different opinion.
Yeah, so things like cutting off, I think it was Jam Jam when he was trying to give an answer, and like throwing it back at him and challenging him. That stuff like that by itself is not going to be decisive, but maybe is emblematic of a larger issue. I actually kind of love to see that. I feel like in this new era, it's kind of nice to see the finalists directly challenging each other as opposed to keeping up this love fest, but subtly or not so subtly trying to suggest that, oh, actually, I'm more deserving. I kind of like just putting the other people on the spot and making them justify their positions. But
to cut you off fittingly here, I think if the jury were inclined to vote for her, that's easily something they could cite as, hey, that she stood up for herself like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, you asked me what I would have Heidi do differently, and I'll try to answer that, I guess. It's kind of a difficult question, though, because the answers are either A, play a different game in the 20-something days prior, or B, like, it doesn't matter even if she gave the best pitch imaginable, she was still getting exactly Danny's vote and nobody else's, and that's the way it was going to be. And I almost wonder now the opposite question of how bad of a Final Tribal would you have needed to have to lose Daddy's vote? Because I mean, that was one of the funniest arcs of the whole thing, is Daddy saying, yeah, I wouldn't vote for my own mother if she was up there and didn't wow me, and then just votes for his buddy Heidi after she messes it up, which is perfectly within his rights to do. And this actually leads to a serious point about one of the deficiencies of this new era, is that because you have these cars full of superfans who are hyper aware of, like, the metagame and how the game is being perceived and how their jury votes are going to be perceived and discussed, then people are so loath to give the honest answer of, yeah, I voted for them because I was close to them the whole game and I like them and I want to like acknowledge them and you know, have them receive some recognition. So Danny has to dress it up in some way rather than saying, yeah, Heidi's my friend, so I voted for her, which, like, James kind of did that with Cassidy, and it was refreshing that he did. It's like, yeah, I like Cass, so I voted for her. And the debates after that season would have been better, I think, if some members of the jury who voted for Gabler who just said, yeah, we didn't like Cassidy, so we didn't vote for her. That's how Survivor works. Deal with it. But no one can really do that because we're all engaged in this discussion of like resumes and everything. And that actually, to circle back to your question, is something that I might have had Heidi do differently, is it felt like when I was watching her performance this episode, it did feel like a performance. It felt like she was adopting the role that she felt she needed to adopt and played it brilliantly until Final Tribal. But when she gave up immunity and was saying, I'm explicitly in front of the jury, I am doing this to build my resume, like, because acknowledging that you need to have moves on your resume is seen itself as a sign of like Survivor awareness now. That to me, I think that if you have to make it explicit, it's probably a sign that it's not going to work, if that makes sense. And I don't know if you kind of need to do it and for it to be seen as some like authentic spur of the moment thing and not as a calculated move, even though their skepticism about Heidi in the first place is what forces her to make that calculated move in order to win their respect.
So I certainly see what you're saying, and it is kind of an interesting paradox, but I would also say, without being able to cite any examples off the top of my head, that explicitly citing a resume has worked out for other people in the past. And it was Steven who tweeted on finale night, or may not have been on finale night, but it was definitely Steven who tweeted something to the effect of, the thing about Survivor juries is they vote for whoever they feel like voting for, and then they will retcon reasons for why they did that after the fact. And I personally agree with that. Where do you land on that kind of issue? Because I feel like Heidi is an illustration to me, and this may be just kind of a different branch of the same point we've already been kind of making or getting at, of were the jury predisposed to voting for Heidi, I think that could have been another thing that they were citing as, yep, that's exactly why I'm voting for Heidi, because she has point A, point B, point D, point C even in there in order as well on her resume, and that's what I'm looking for.
No, I think you and Stephen are totally right, and I am relying here on your encyclopedic memory of Stephen's tweets to bridge the gap.
It's my homepage, it's twitter.com/StephenFishback.
Given that it's been, you know, 2 weeks since the finale now, but no, I think it's totally right. It's been true for 40-something seasons. It will be true for as long as Survivor continues to exist, despite Jeff's very explicit attempts to steer it in another direction, right, where this entire jury format is essentially an attempt to give some like formal criteria for how to weigh up your jury vote and gloss over the fact that, yeah, none of this is going to matter if they like you more than the other person.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think that has always been true. That's always going to be true. And so yeah, we can point to things that, oh, I don't know if this was a good look for Heidi or whatever, but like, I don't know what she could have done. And this might be actually a historically important development for future seasons, because they can look at what Heidi did here, where she won immunity, like the most important immunity, then again gave it up, went into fire, broke the all-time fire making record to get the biggest jury threat out of the game, and it still didn't count for anything. Hopefully that removes the pressure on future players to feel like they need to give up their final immunity that they worked so hard to win, or all of these absurd gestures, and also signals to future juries that like, players don't need to do this in order to embellish their resume at the last minute for you to take them seriously. Although, having said that, I wonder now if that choice of do you keep immunity, do you go into fire, that might be the go-to excuse for people on the jury for why whoever lost the vote at the end could have done more, because it's like the last point of agency that they had in the game, without having to fess up to that basic fact of Survivor that, you know, you vote for who you like or respect more for the most part. So, you know, Cassidy in 43 was the perfect case study in this, right? Where you had all this stuff of, oh, well, if she had given up immunity and beat Jesse in fire herself, we would have voted for her. No, you wouldn't. And that's okay, because you didn't want to vote for Cassidy because you didn't like her. But we can't just come out and say that, so we have to dress it up in a bunch of these different ways. And from the other direction, I think that this general notion of, like, a lot of the people who say, yeah, juries vote for who they like more, will say in the same breath that, well, yeah, whoever won played the best game or played the best social game and so on, thinking that those two points support each other. But I think, if anything, they're kind of in conflict, because if it's the case that juries just vote for who they like more, often who they like more is a very, like, ephemeral thing or an irrational thing, not in a negative sense, but just, yeah, you like who you like, right? You get a good vibe from this person, you get a bad vibe from this other person, and if the person who you just don't gel with is explicitly trying to fix that, well, often that just makes the problem worse, right? And you can tell yourself that, well, they're trying too hard or whatever. So I think that the discourse would be a lot healthier in all directions if we just acknowledge that, yeah, juror A will vote for person X over person Y, and that doesn't mean that person Y played worse or could have done something to win over the hearts and minds of juror A. Like, no, this is just how the process worked. This is what we all signed up for, so let's just be honest about what that is.
Yeah, and I think, first of all, it is interesting to consider the idea that now people on future seasons may have less pressure to both give up the necklace and go into fire, or vote based on someone doing that, although it sounds like we're on very much the same page, that I don't think it really matters, that to at least nearly the extent that it is generally made out to matter, in terms of, like, people giving up the necklace and that being like a tipping point in terms of that swings them from winning versus losing. We'll see what becomes of that. I'm primarily going to remain of the opinion, I would imagine, that the jury will just continue voting for who they like, who they were already going to vote for, independent of that sort of thing. But I believe it is now yet another instance, and please correct me if I'm wrong on some of these examples, Dom. We have Tommy Sheehan taken to Final Tribal Council. Doesn't have to win immunity, doesn't have to make a fire, just gets taken to Final Tribal Council. He wins. Marianne gets taken to Final Tribal Council, and now Jam Jam as well, right? Jam Jam is given a seat at Final Tribal Council, but Carolyn kind of got the "I would have taken this person" treatment. Can we count Jam Jam as a person who was taken in spirit to Final Tribal Council?
Sure. Did you mention Erica as well?
I did not, because I was not 100% sure, but it crossed my mind, and I didn't want to say it and be wrong.
No, well, that was the big mic drop moment where, you know, Xander announced he was taking Erica because he felt that she hadn't done enough and was perceived as the lesser threat, and how wrong he turned out to be.
Okay, so larger point, thank you for adding to it, Dom. I really think it barely matters, if even at all, unless you're in that kind of Chris Underwood or Natalie Anderson spot where you were out of the game for the vast majority of it and you have to do literally everything within your power to get to Final Tribal Council and win. I really think this has been a talking point that has been going on for obviously many years now in 2023 that, for my money, very rarely makes even a one vote difference compared to how things would have gone if the person had gotten there through pretty much any other means. I think it largely comes down to, Dom, something you just brought up a couple minutes ago, and I would say Jam Jam is, at least in my mind, an all-time illustration of this, and that is just the vibes the jurors get from the people between whom they are choosing. And I would say Jam Jam, at the risk of overstating it, an all-time great vibes Survivor player. Like, I'm not going to be the one sitting here saying Jam Jam is necessarily the next Kim Spradlin or whatever. At the same time, I don't know that he's that far off. I mean, I really struggle to come up with any point, at least of what we got to see on TV or anything I've heard from Jam Jam in various interviews or seen online or whatever, where this guy was anything other than a 10 out of 10 vibe guy. Where are you on Jam Jam, like, along those lines? Because at least as far as I'm concerned, this dude is like borderline magic with how he's able to maintain that seemingly 24/7.
Well, I think he is one of those people who, he's not totally unvarnished, right? Like, he will have these moments with you, and he'll get into these, like, these little tiffs or these little spats with people, and you know, he'll call people out or he'll gossip behind their backs or whatever, but he just has this vibe where, like, that's okay, and like, oh, that's just Jam Jam, and you kind of want to be with on the right side of that rather than the wrong side, and it's just part of his overall character. It was funny, I think, when this story became Jam Jam versus Josh, and they had like this rivalry where it's like, oh yeah, we're kind of on the same page and kind of the same character in a lot of ways, but we both, like, because of that, we understand who the other one is enough to know what the deal is and see through the bullshit. And so yeah, them like going toe to toe was very funny. But yeah, I think Jam Jam, as you said, gave off a good vibe. And honestly, at Final Tribal, he did one of the best jobs I've ever seen of connecting this was my explicit mental strategy part of the game to the ultimately this game is just about vibes in the first place aspect, where like he linked up how he used vibes and how he used emotions in a really ingenious way, I think, which, like, if he wasn't doing that and he just thought of it to explain it, that would be amazing in its own right. But I think it was genuine. It did seem like that's what he was doing. And when he framed it as, I could see the twinkle in your eye during these genuine moments, and that's how I knew when that twinkle wasn't there that you weren't being genuine with me. Like, that was just such a perfect encapsulation of both his style of play and also why the truth is about Survivor, I think. And so that to me is like, that's what you have to do, and someone who can do that is just going to be a phenomenal player, regardless of any, you know, minor instance or whatever that they might have with people.
Yeah, I'm going to butcher the retelling of this, but like, when one of his answers was something to the effect of, yes, not only was I using you for that purpose, I was using all of you for that purpose, and like, the whole jury is eating it up. I think those sorts of behavioral tendencies from Jam Jam almost serve to add to the otherwise kind of like impeccable social game that he was playing, where those rougher moments, which are by no means rough compared to some of the other rough moments people have on Survivor, I think really add to helping him come across as like authentic and genuine, which I think is a vital piece of playing good Survivor. And with all of that in mind, I think Jam Jam is without a doubt one of the most impressive players, certainly of the new era, if not for quite some time leading up to that. To return, Dom, I don't mean to grill you on this, but I was a big Jam Jam fan the entire way through. I gather you are quite impressed, to say the least, with the game he ended up playing. Did you find yourself a legit kind of Jam Jam stand by the end of this?
I mean, I warmed to him for sure, and especially that scene of him with Carson in the finale, just comforting him and teaching him to make fire against himself, potentially. Like, I mean, how can you not love the guy after that, right? So yeah, I'm not as all in on Jam Jam as some have been, and like don't have like a personal stake in his success the way that some people do. But yeah, I mean, no complaints about him as the winner of the season at all.
Okay. I don't think there are many out there who have, I'm sure there are plenty, don't get me wrong, on like Facebook Survivor or whatever, all the stone cold boomers out there who hate Jam Jam or whatever that I just never get any kind of glimpse of.
Okay. So the thing about that though is, who would they have wanted to win the season instead? Because if their complaint is that, you know, well, Survivor is so woke these days, and or, you know, they're all so like weak and effeminate, and they don't even have to survive anymore, whatever. Like, how far back do you have to look in the season to find someone that they would have wanted to win? Like, I guess Danny maybe would have qualified, but like, it's not like, oh, they're so mad that Carson got robbed or something. They probably didn't have that much time for him either.
Yeah, I'm for whatever reason inspired now to pull up Shane Power's Twitter page just to see what he had to say about the Survivor finale. And I got to this tweet from late May that says, none of them were capable ever, and it's fine closure that two of the three of them realized it. And then I found out he's talking about Succession and not Survivor. And so I may have to dig a little deeper, but while talking on a podcast might not be the time to go that route. But yeah, I don't know what the people who are upset with a Jam Jam win would have even necessarily been rooting for. But I get the sense in the grand scheme of things that Jam Jam is probably a pretty popular, to say the least, kind of winner within the grand scheme of just the Survivor fandom, and the Facebook people are going to say whatever the Facebook people say. So Dom, let me ask you what you thought about the kind of wrapping up of Carolyn's storyline, at least on this season, although I don't think you're wrong in earlier saying that she's probably one of the bigger locks, if she's so inclined, to get a second chance here. What did you think of seeing her ultimately go from scrappy underdog early on to like legit power player within the game? It seems like she's in there with a real chance, only to get zero jury votes. How did you feel about just the conclusion to Carolyn's giant story this season?
I was sad for her, and she seemed hurt and stung by it. And as she correctly complained about in her exit press, she didn't have time to go and lick her wounds and process that by herself because, oh, hey, guys, let's have a fun celebration for our after show with pizza and God knows what else. And you know, she is still in the spotlight at the one moment where she probably wishes she just had some time to just like go and, you know, nurse her emotions in a room by herself for a bit. But yeah, I think she was an amazingly compelling character and player. And often you kind of have to choose one or the other, right? And it's a rare treat when someone is both at once. And especially when those two things seem to like be so intertwined, as they were with Carolyn, where I think like her style made her very compelling to watch, but I think also ensured that she was never going to be taken seriously. And her not being taken seriously was what allowed her to be as effective as she was. And so going all the way back to when there was all of those hijinks with the birdcage and so on, it never seemed to cross people's mind for a second that Carolyn, of all people, could be up to no good where that was concerned. But because of that, she was able to pull the wool over their eyes and get away with murder. But then the difficulty with not being taken seriously is getting people to then take you seriously. And it seemed like that perception was just like too fixed for too long. And coming off the heels of Gabler winning, you would think that anything should be possible in that regard. But again, how much of that was a vote for Gabler? How much of it was just like, well, we're not really inspired by any of you, so we have to tell ourselves a convincing story about why we are in fact excited about, I guess, Gabler. Sure, let's go with that. Whereas here, I think the whole cast agreed, okay, the Tika 3 played a blinder on all of us. One of them deserves to win. We're very happy with that being Jam Jam, even if, and a key point we'll come back to, maybe they wanted it to be Carson instead. And so at that point, like, there's no reason to try and talk yourself into Carolyn, if that makes sense. I think also, like, the discussion about her getting zero votes, we're used to this by now. It's kind of taken for granted that the final three is a failure in part because, well, there's always someone getting zero votes, so what's the point in having it there in the first place? The fact that it's Carolyn, when she was such a big character and a big player over the season, really has stuck with a lot of people, where it's like, okay, if Carolyn, of all people, gets zero votes, then what hope is there for others? And even going back to that very first confessional with Carolyn, right, in the premiere, where they just drilled a hole in the fourth wall and let us see her talking to the producer pre-confessional to set that confessional up, it was clear, okay, something special is going on here. Like, we are meant to really care about this person throughout the whole thing. And so I think they did a good enough job of getting us invested in her enough that when she lost in such a player, it did hurt. That being said, I think that, like, that whole thing of her being so manic and so zany and so on, and so fun to watch, is what, you know, like, understand that in the context of her at Final Tribal not being able to articulate the game that she played, and not, like, justifying why she was different from the other members of the Tika 3 and deserved to win over them. Like, it felt like she had the opportunities to do that, and from what we saw on the screen, didn't do it, and from what people said in the exit press, also did not elaborate there. And for as much as I find it fun to watch her just, like, careening back and forth between different points and, like, losing her mind and almost arguing with herself in her own confessionals, I think hours of that on end would be exhausting either to live with or to watch in a Final Tribal setting. And especially when you're wanting clear answers from that person of, okay, what were you thinking here? Why did you do this here? Why should we want you as the winner of our season? Like, even in after the fact, in her own exit press, she's doing the same thing in the low stakes setting of an interview where she's getting to talk to her audience of adoring fans. She still is giving that same manic energy to it. And it's kind of difficult to follow the thread of what she's saying. So love to watch that. Love to see it. But I get why people weren't wanting to vote for that.
Yeah, I totally co-sign everything you just laid out about Carolyn and her story this season. I will add, in that exit press, she did, when she was on RHAP, like the day or two after the finale, get the most important jury vote, that of course being Sia's jury vote that got her an extra 100,000. You know, not as good as winning the game, but certainly better than getting a couple of jury votes and getting sole second place in general.
I will say on that as well that for as much as Carolyn is maybe the biggest lock as a returnee in the new era, she may be the biggest lock for the Sia money of all time that we've ever seen. Like, from that first confessional in the first episode, like, yeah, you could tell Sia was getting the wallet out already.
Yeah, I do wonder if, like, I don't fault Carolyn for not thinking this would necessarily be the case in the moment, and I may be wrong that this even was the case overall, but it, in retrospect, feels, at least to me, like, as incredible as the run the Tika 3 went on absolutely was, I do wonder if Carolyn essentially lost the game as soon as both Carson and Jam Jam were there at Final Four.
And she was given that classic subplot for people in that larger alliance of, okay, this is maybe the last point where I could break away and do something else and blindside my former allies and try and go to the end with a different group of people. And she didn't follow through on that. And so if you want to pinpoint, like, a turning, a turning point where something else could have happened, maybe that is it. And even through Final Six, Final Five, she's entertaining the idea of flipping on Carson, flipping on Jam Jam, but just ultimately can't bring herself to do it.
What a story it would be, though, right? If she had, like, that would be, she's already like an all-time Survivor character. If she had ripped the hearts out of Jam Jam and Carson at like Final Five and Final Four en route to victory, that'd be unbelievable. And like, they would sing songs about her for decades.
Or en route to losing. Either way, that's a phenomenal story to watch play out. And honestly, it might still have led to her losing, I think, if she goes there with Jamie or Lauren or whoever. Like, maybe she was just doomed and she did the best she could. But like, there's a lot of debate over, well, okay, we get why Jam Jam had to win. No one actually seems to be complaining about that, but why did she get zero votes? Surely someone should have voted for her, and specifically Franny, perhaps, should have voted for her. When Franny says, you know, Caroline, you changed my life, but I'm still just going to vote for Jam Jam like everyone else. Which, I get why people are confused by that, but I think that, firstly, they agreed that Atika Meba needed to win, and if Jam Jam, like, got medevaced on day 26, and it was Caroline versus Heidi, then I think Caroline gets the same votes that Jam Jam gets. And if you had some ranked choice voting system or whatever, is, I think for most people there, is Jam Jam 1, Caroline 2, and Heidi a perhaps distant third. So I don't think people were saying, oh yeah, Caroline is just a goat, and clearly, you know, none of them are worthy of being in Jam Jam's present. It was just, well, we have to vote for one of them, and I think Jam Jam did a better job at convincing me and playing the game than Caroline, and everyone thought that, and so even Franny, it seemed like, and so they're all just going to vote for Jam Jam, and so it's not like they tactically agreed amongst themselves to, we're going to shut out Caroline, or they could have coordinated so that, like, well, yeah, we think Caroline deserves exactly 1.5 votes, so let's agree among ourselves for who those 1.5 votes are going to be. Like, that's just not how it works most of the time. And so, yeah, I like to think if I'd been out there, I would have considered Caroline, but I honestly probably would have voted for Jam Jam still, like everyone else.
Yeah, and I, if it's not clear, was a big Caroline fan from pillar to post in terms of what she was bringing to the show. Disappointed on one hand that she didn't get any jury votes, but for reasons that I think you laid out really well, not the most surprising thing in the world to me. My one concern about Caroline actually has nothing to do with anything Caroline did. My concern, and hopefully it is an unfounded one, is that the producers and people casting the show these days, obviously, and for understandable reasons, were big Caroline fans as well. And what I do not want to see happen is a series of attempts at recapturing the lightning in a bottle that Caroline was in the form of various kind of cheap Caroline knockoffs over the next several years. I think that could lead to some darker timelines.
So do you think that Caroline is, and bear with me here, is she so unique as a character that it's going to be hard to get that same lightning in a bottle, and it's not even worth trying, so we look for other people who are very unique in their own ways? Or do you try and cram Caroline into this historic mold of, oh, well, she's like a Debbie or a Nora who is not actually batshit insane and does actually have the wherewithal to get things done in Survivor?
Consider yourself born with. I think it is, if I'm understanding the way you laid that out correctly, I think it's the latter, where I'm now deeply nervous that I interpreted those two options backwards. But what I believe about Caroline is she, of course, is authentically very much the way that we saw her on TV in terms of all the kind of zaniness going on with her, seemingly pretty close to 24/7. At the same time, though, I think there is far more to her than that, in ways that I don't think I would necessarily say about Debbie or about Nora, where I think Caroline was a legitimately sharp observer of what was going on around her. And I don't know that I would take it to the most extreme kind of version of that and say she was deliberately acting this way and was masterminding all these things because she was acting in such a way that made people not take her seriously. I think she was just being her authentic self, and part of her authentic self is that observational ability that is going to make her valuable as an ally and like a good survivor thinker in general, with whatever is left to be desired in terms of implementation kind of being set aside. Is that roughly the camp that I answered your question with? I'm deeply nervous that I did this backwards.
I'm not even sure myself anymore, but what I'm trying to say basically is, to me, Karen stands out as a one of a kind, and I think that is generally agreed that that's what she is, and I don't know where you would go looking for people like Karen if you wanted to find them. I think if they happen to stumble through your door as casting, fantastic, right? But I don't think you can really try to get these, like, bargain basement Karens the way that after Tony won, we did see an increase in the number of, Joe Miners and War Dogs and so on, who bear a striking resemblance in some ways, but perhaps not in others, to the great Tony Vatros. But
I don't think it would be that difficult to get bargain basement Carolins who are just in my mind, as much as, so Nora is too good of a casting choice in my view to be viewed as like a bargain basement Carolin, but I think it wouldn't be that difficult to find people who bring similar energy to Carolyn, who are not nearly the survivor thinkers that Carolyn was out there.
Oh, I agree, but I think most of those people just get understood as, oh, well, there is any character, and perhaps not as this is a deliberate attempt to channel the magic of Carolyn, perhaps in vain, once again.
I wonder if they do go the direction of trying to find more people in that Carolyn mold, at least in the immediate aftermath of season 44 airing. So I'm guessing the people on season 45 got to see at least the beginning of this. I think that's the case. And then obviously 46 will have seen the entire thing. I do wonder if there's going to be an almost unwarranted target on some of the wackier characters that are out there on these next couple seasons, because people are so concerned about not letting the next Carolyn get one over on them.
Maybe, although I don't know if, to use the Tony parallel again, I don't know if the knockoff Tonys that we had down the line actually experienced that same blowback, right? Like, I think part of that is you suss out the vibe of the person quickly, and you think, like, well, yeah, clearly they are cast in the mold of a Tony, but they're not Tony. You know, War Dog does not, in fact, have the dog in him. You know,
oh, I just so I think, sorry to cut you off and immediately interrupt you and disagree, but I think Joe Mena probably left a bit to be desired as far as a survivor player. I haven't seen Edge of Extinction in a while, but if memory serves, we were in here quite frequently talking about how shocking it was that War Dog seemed to legitimately have like complete control over what was going on.
Right, but it's shocking because of the just how he carries himself and the vibe he gives off and so on, and it's not
calls himself the War Dog constantly, well, in the third
among
person.
Other things, yes, it's not the fact that he bears some like physical or otherwise resemblance to Tony, like it's the actual resemblance, right, or the apparent resemblance, if you get my drift there. But in any case, going back to the final outcome for a second, one point that did cause some debate, and which ties into, you know, previous final tribal outcomes from seasons past that have been memory hold at this point, is there was a point raised by Franny actually about how, well, Carolyn came across as like outwardly emotional, but that is, you know, emotions are a key part of Survivor, and so trying to navigate that, reconcile that, is something that everyone has to deal with. How did she do it, and how did the other people at Final Tribal do it? And this is where I think Jam Jam gave a phenomenal answer, right? Where he linked his actual emotions and his understanding of other people's emotions and his strategy, and just tied those threads together in this perfect way. Whereas Carolyn, I think, accounted for herself and like her authentic emotions very well, but didn't like link that into, well, yeah, this is how my being grounded as a person in this way, and me living up to my own true self actually allowed me to function in this way in the game of Survivor. So, like, for as much as you can fit it into an old narrative of, well, Carolyn was raked over the coals for being emotional in a way that, for example, if Carson had made it there and his turmoil was given more understanding, like, that, I would get why people would want to apply that framework to it a little bit more. And yeah, if Carson wins in the same mold of, well, yeah, we've seen the Adam Kleins and the Cochrans and so on of the past, then I would understand that framing a bit more. As it is, though, it's like, well, okay, if you're playing that game, like, the people that Carolyn is there with are Jam Jam and Heidi, two contestants from Puerto Rico who belong in these various groups themselves and who, like, if you're trying to give some power ranking of who the jury is most likely to be biased against in various ways, like, I think Carolyn is a distant third on that list, despite right. being, you know, the wacky white lady that everyone is rooting for.
This is a question that I doubt you're going to have a way of giving a knowledgeable answer to, but I'm going to ask you anyway, just because I don't know where I even land on this myself. Do you think that if Jeff and the other, you know, Van Wagenen, the super higher-up producers could just wave a magic wand and, like, unilaterally cast the only jury vote for the winner, do you think they would have rather had Carolyn win this season than Jam Jam?
I don't know, honestly. That is a very good question. I think they understood they were onto casting gold with Carolyn, from the way that they used her so inventively with that confessional at the start all the way through. And then Jeff seemed enthusiastic about giving Carolyn the chance to tell her story at every opportunity. I think they wanted to get everything they could out of Carolyn. Whether they thought that would or should culminate in her winning, that is tough to say, I think. Do you have a thought on that?
I've waffled back and forth on it. Like, I have a hard time removing my own kind of perspective from this, and as far as I'm concerned, I think Jam Jam is, like, exactly what I, and thus everyone, should want in a Survivor winner. But from a, like, TV show perspective, I would not be remotely surprised if they would have rather seen Carolyn win. And I honestly wonder, in whatever universe Carolyn did win, I don't know necessarily that her story over the course of the season would have looked a whole lot different. And I also don't know if Jam Jam, if he's one of the people that she's beating at Final Tribal Council, if he would have looked that much different along the way either, other than, I'm guessing, the finale itself, where over the course of the finale, as willing as I was to believe that any of the three of them had at least some shot at winning once the final three was, like, established, I was very much over the course of that 2 hours and change leading up to the final vote reveal getting further and further towards the camp of, okay, I'll be quite surprised if Jam Jam is not the winner here. And I think I could see, like, the finale presentation changing a meaningful amount in the world where Carolyn ends up winning. But other than that, I don't think it would be crazy on their part or inconsistent at all to present Carolyn the virtually identically to how they actually did, even in the timeline where she gets zero votes. I think that is just the authentic Carolyn that would honestly be kind of difficult to present any other way, no matter the result.
Yeah, this is where that counterfactual then of, what if Carson had not been slayed by Heidi? I don't know if they could be nearly as satisfied with the story of Carson, because it did seem like he was regarded as the bigger threat, and had, if we get the Ortega final three, Carson probably wins, I think, if he can hold it together. So, like, with Carolyn, you have this unique character with an amazing story to tell. With Jam Jam, you have this, like, sparkling character who is able to convey how he used his charm and his strategy in this way, which I think will go down as, like, one of the canonical final tribal answers. If Carson just shows up and gives this very rote response of, well, yeah, this is how I use my relationships in the game, and these are the strategic moves I made and whatever. Like, okay, you're ticking all the boxes you have to tick, but there's, I'm not sure what the takeaway is at that point.
So, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here. I believe you just said something to the effect of, like, if it is the Tika 3 at Final Tribal Council, Carson likely just converts the win there. I'm going to issue an official Sandra Diaz Twine. I don't know about that. Again, maybe I'm letting my own personal feelings about how the season played out and who excelled in which different areas way too heavily into this. But I am nowhere near ready to say that Carson would even be the favorite against Jam Jam. Hey, have we heard from the jurors about how that would have gone?
I don't think there's been, I don't know if they've been explicitly asked about that, but that was the vibe I got in my understanding of like the brief press tour that they all did. But I will say quickly, regardless of that, Carson even being in the mix in that regard at the tender age of 20 is, I think, a really impressive feat where, like we've mentioned before, how tough it is for people that young to ever be taken seriously to the point where you have like Sammy from last season. But he's 19, but he's going to tell everyone he's 22 so that, you know, that they don't write him off out of the gate. For Carson to be that well-connected socially at that young of an age, I think is a genuinely impressive testament to his skills as a player, even if those skills are much less telegenic than his other Alliance members.
So I don't disagree with that. I think anyone playing as solid of both a social and strategic game as Carson did at age 20 is an immensely uphill battle. And I would say, you know, it seemed like Sammy was doing a decent job there for a while. And there have been other cases of very young people playing quite well, to say the least, over the 20 plus year history of Survivor. But Carson definitely does stand out even among the very successful young players of the game. And while having already said that, I think Jam Jam would at the very least be competitive with Carson, if not the outright favorite, I simultaneously wouldn't be surprised at all if we did find out that Carson would have done very, very well with the jury in pretty much any conceivable timeline where he found himself there at Final Tribal Council. And Dom, that is what makes it all the more painful to have no choice but to get into what, Dominic?
You tell me, Colin.
You already know, and I'm sure a huge chunk of the audience already knows as well. As much as I enjoyed Carson all season long, loved the heart that he brought to the game, loved the skill that he brought to the game, loved the effort that he brought to the game in the form of 3D printing every puzzle that's ever existed in the history of the show and making sure that when that very predictably comes up for him, he is going to have no problem handling it. How on earth do you show up to Final Four completely hopeless at fire making when you know, as stupid as it is, none of us that I know of, other than Jeff Probst himself, like that this is a part of the game. It is, however, absolutely a part of the game, a predictable part of the game, and a high, high impact part of the game. I think it is totally possible that the difference between Carson being 20 years old and playing one of the most impressive young person games in the history of the show, being a $1 million winner, cementing his place in Survivor history, versus Carson, the final juror, who had, yeah, a story that we're all going to remember, and we may see him on a future season, but he's going to go back to NASA, and his life's not really going to be all that different. I could easily see the only difference between those two timelines is he did not practice fire. And that to me is, I know, Dom, you're sighing. We do this every single time. We did it with Jesse last time. How many times in a row do we need to watch someone not know how to make their fire? And that is the difference between them winning the game and winning the $1 million and having this thing that will be in their obituary. Sorry to put it in such morbid terms, but, like, that is how significant all of this is, and it totally could have been prevented by just practicing fire.
Well, Carson's only 20. Hopefully that obituary is a fair ways off.
Again, I just mean, this is, as stupid as it is, such an important thing, and I am happy to grant that when you're at home, it is damn near impossible to replicate the actual station you're going to have for fire making, the supplies, whatever, but it is so painful to me. Carson this time, Jesse last season, Lauren Ashley Beck is another one of my favorites from her season, that it's just devastating to me to see these people play such good games and run into this extraordinarily predictable final hurdle and just break down in tears because they've done zero preparation and they know they are completely fucked. No, like, that is no. Crazy as we all think it is, it is just a part of the way the game works now, and it is heartbreaking to me to have to come in here and do this every single damn time.
We get it. I don't think you have to at this point. But
well,
I
enjoy
understand.
Hearing about it next time, too, and I'll put a pin in it until then.
If we do podcast about 45, I will pencil that in for the finale there as well, too. But it is funny that, you know, you wouldn't download a car. You wouldn't 3D print a fire, apparently. And it is a jarring contrast that someone who goes to such lengths to study for every other aspect of the game just had that, like, glaring hole in their preparation, which I'm sure Carson was doing the time for that in advance, but just that didn't carry over to on the island, apparently. But before he'd even attempt it,
when he found, you know, they're at Final Four, I think he's hoping to either win the necklace or get taken. When it became clear to him that he was quite likely going to have to make a fire, it seemed like he understood, okay, my game is just over now.
So that actually sets up an interesting question of, let's say one of Carolyn or Jam Jam had made fire or had won immunity. Do they, understanding that Carson does not feel confident in fire, do they take Carson and leave, let's say, the other one of Carolyn, Jam Jam, whoever it is, to make fire against Heidi? Like, if the goal is to have the all-Tika Final Three, that's the best way to get that, right? Or do they understand, hey, if we think Carson's going to win, probably should not let him get a free pass to the finals, and so hope that Heidi beats him instead, and that would have worked out.
So if those are two, like, diametrically opposed goals, as far as I can tell, of if the plan is let's get all three of us into the finals and see what happens from there, then yeah, if Carson is clearly feeling awful about his chances in fire against anyone, then of course you have him be one of the people that doesn't have to make the fire. But if you are nervous that Carson's going to win if you let him get to Final Tribal Council, you basically always make him make the fire.
Yeah, so that would have been potentially a like Denise and Malcolm style test of just how badly do you want this? Do you value the storyline of we've stuck it out together, we were there from day one, we made it all the way to the end, or do you want to maximize your own chance of winning $1 million? And that really would have been tested in classic Survivor fashion there.
So I think I would be open to the possibility that Carolyn might be of the view that, hey, it would be awesome if the three of us started together, ran through this whole game, and then got to sit at the end together. I would be very skeptical that Jam Jam would ever be on that same page if he thought it meant he would have a significantly worse chance of winning.
That is the vibe that I get too. Although he did, like, tutor Carson in potentially how to beat himself in fire, which I don't know, like, if that had happened, if that storyline had come to such an amazing conclusion, Carson, like, the student becomes a master, Carson beats Jam Jam in fire, you could paint that as just one of the biggest unforced errors of all time, or you could say, look, it's kind of a mistake to even think about it in strategic terms. He was just being the guy that he is, and the whole point of Survivor is to draw out the tension between being the guy or whatever that you are and, you know, having this, like, cutthroat mentality in the game. So I kind of would have wanted to see that play out itself. If I was Carson, I would almost be consoling myself or excusing myself with the fact that even if I had studied fire for hundreds of hours and I was this amazing fire maker. I could be the second fastest fire maker in the whole history of Survivor and still have lost. And they, whatever, you know, Heidi just, you gotta give it up to Heidi.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed to me, I could be mistaken about this, but I'd be quite surprised if Heidi had not put some significant effort into fire making leading up to that, just given the very strong history of people making fire in that Final Four challenge and her coming out with the best time ever. I would be highly inclined to just give Heidi a ton of credit for being very prepared for what was obviously coming her way.
Yeah, I think that's a fair reading of it as well. Where do we want to go from there then? Is there anything else from the Final Tribal that you think is worth touching on, or anything else from earlier in the finale that we want to get to?
I was going to ask you the exact same thing, Dom. What am I forgetting about in terms of highlights from Final Tribal Council? Because at least as I was watching, it really started with Jam Jam in a confessional, I think, leading into the Final Tribal Council segment when they were all still, I think, on the beach talking about what their thoughts were like going into that night. When Jam Jam gave the confessional saying something to the effect of, how I see things and how they played out to this point is almost irrelevant because I'm not the one voting. I need to pitch this through the eyes of the jury and more or less pander to what they are going to like and respect. From the moment I heard that, I was pulling very, very hard for a person thinking along those lines to end up converting and doing a good job. And so I watched this entire Final Tribal Council rooting very hard for Jam Jam and being very impressed by pretty much whatever he ended up saying. And it seems like the rest of the jury was on pretty much that same page throughout. I guess the Final Tribal Council talking point that I've heard come up the most is that of the overall just kind of like positivity that it seems like was rubbing a lot of Facebook boomers the wrong way. And the, both the jurors and fellow Final Tribal Council participants like applauding each other and giving credit where it was due and having people, you know, really go to bat for themselves, and everyone was happy and giving respect to everyone for everything they did. What is the balance that you would like to see at Final Tribal Council? Because I was not personally bothered, but to say the least, by the way that this all played out in a very kind of like sportsmanlike way. But I do get on one hand, certainly the people, to use like an extreme example, who were saying, what the hell happened to Sue Hawk or like Corinne Kaplan in Gabon, and the vicious jury speeches we used to get. Like, I certainly understand the appeal of that sort of thing. Where are you on just the overall tone of this Final Tribal Council and what that means about where Survivor is at?
Yeah, so I think that, firstly, the shift to this Final Tribal format, part of that, and I think an intentional part of that, was to decenter the jury members who, even though this is, in theory, their chance to shine again and their chance to have the say over the most important final outcome, it's not about any individual person anymore. It's just about the jury and the process. And so, like, I think I asked this question to you in one, and I can't even remember which one it was, but it may have been all of our post, you know, our post 40 wrap-up episodes. What was the last memorable Final Tribal moment that you can remember where, you know, one jury member gave some memorable quote or performance or really did something to stick in your mind after this long?
Number one, you were asking very much the wrong person along those lines. And as I now desperately try to scramble through the Rolodex of exciting, like, I don't even know if this counts, and it certainly doesn't count in the spirit of what you're asking, but I would say, like, the only really, like, big memory of any even, like, semi-recent season that I have that revolves around Final Tribal Council is, number one, just the sheer shock of Gabler winning 43, and number two, Wendell and Dom being a tie. Or like, and this is completely not in, again, the spirit of what you're asking in terms of like jurors going back and forth, but it has been a damn long time since I have any lasting memories along those. So I'm stalling for time here because I know I am just overlooking something. Like, just mathematically, I have to be. It sounds like you were not going to be able to put me out of my misery along those lines.
No, I don't think there's an example that you're forgetting about. Like the
I have
format
to be.
Now. No, I don't think you are. Like, if we had like Shannon Gates or someone in it, I don't know if they might have some ones that they enjoyed, but I don't think even they would say any of it is on the order of, you know, Eric Cardona or, I mean, whatever your favorite example is from back in the day. Like, the new format explicitly is designed to stop jurors from making themselves a spectacle, and it has done that successfully, to use that word in a very neutral way. So there's that. But also, that now is going alongside this wider trend that I think completely defines the show now to just remove the possibility of conflict. You see this at every stage, whether it's the type of people they cast, where it's, I know there was a lot of back and forth between different camps over, like, what does diversity mean in the context of Modern Survivor? And things like the Diversity Initiative are working out very well, and there are a lot of ways where the show is just a broader range of perspectives than there ever has been. The one thing that is completely lacking there, though, is they're all superfans who all have been trained to view the game in a certain way and who all do view the game in a certain way, and they also have this awareness of how, as superfans, like, they will be judged by their fellow superfans and what's going to be said about them on podcasts and on the internet and on Reddit and so on. And so there's this shared understanding of how the game has to be played, which doesn't allow for any hint of, oh, well, that person is bitter, or any like actual personal conflict. And when that is there, it is very quickly taken out back and shoved down the memory hole. So it's not that they don't cast people who are capable of that. Like, Sydney in 41 comes to mind, actually, as someone who, by all reports after the fact, was could have been the Courtney Yates of her era or the current captain of her era, potentially. And yet we got a very watered down version of that instead. So even when there is that chance for conflict, it is just explicitly worked out of the mix. And I think the thing that is leading to all of this is your very astute read that has now been explicitly confirmed that this is a show for kids now. Like, that is the target audience. And Jeff has said as much on his podcast and on the show this season. And if you are marketing your show at kids, well, you don't want there to be the kind of like awkward scenes that they don't really understand or are going to cause awkward discussions at the dinner table. You want it to be heroes and heroines, and even when someone loses, there's not the sense of crushing disappointment that you might expect when you have a chance at your life dream and you fail at it. You don't get the Jacob Derwins of the world anymore. I don't know if that's a story they're emotionally equipped to tell. Instead, it's, well, even if I failed in one sense, I learned so much about myself and I inspired myself, and hey, I probably inspired a bunch of people out there as well, whether it's young girls in STEM or it's Carson's, whatever it is, wherever you fall on that spectrum, you've been inspired and you are inspiring, so good for you. And there's no real chance for interpersonal conflict or any chance for any larger sense of you could fail at this, you could be bad at this. All of that is kind of swept under the rug now. And so that manifests itself in what you see at Final Tribal the way that it does in every other aspect of the show, whether it's the challenges, whether it's, you know, fill in the blank. Like, that is the show's overarching philosophy now.
Right. And I agree with, I think, something that you mentioned near the top of this point, which is I do not at all think that these casts are necessarily ones that will rarely have any kind of like spicy conflicts emerge, or rarely even have super disappointing outcomes and players who are really upset with themselves emerge. I think the difference is it's just unlike the first couple of decades of Survivor, almost never going to be presented that way to the audience. And I think the only amendment I would make to what you just said is you are right that I spent like years saying, okay, this is a show for kids now. I think I'm actually going to make a slight modification on that, which is unlike Big Brother, which I think has been a show for kids for a long, long time. I think Survivor is a show for families, and it's not going to be a fun family experience if the kid is, or your kids are, weeping very often at the end of the episodes, or certainly on finale night because their favorite didn't win, or anything along those lines. So the general point I definitely still stand by, but I think there is a slight distinction between a show for kids, and I think Survivor is very deliberately a show for families now. And for what it's worth, from a TV economics perspective, I have a hard time faulting them for that. Like, the television is a highly, highly tumultuous industry over the last at least decade or so, where simply as a network, as CBS is, simply retaining the same viewers you had the previous year is like a huge win. And I think Survivor has just been on for long enough that, well, there was definitely, I think, a noticeable kind of pandemic bump for people who had nothing to do other than binge Survivor, which is a show they hadn't seen before, but they tried it out during lockdown and they loved it. And I think they did get kind of an influx in non-children viewers in that hyper-specific and hopefully not to be replicated kind of circumstance. But generally speaking, I think people, Dom, even significantly younger than us, who have not yet watched Survivor for one reason or another, are pretty unlikely to ever someday randomly get into Survivor. And I think it is a logical kind of bet that Jeff and the rest of the producers are making, that if we want to continue making new seasons of this, which it very much at this point seems like they do, and I'm happy, at least today, that that continues to be the case, I get it why they are saying, look, anyone who is certainly like a millennial or older, and we may already be pushing it with some of the like older side of Gen Z, anyone in any of that age range who has not already gotten into Survivor is pretty unlikely to someday get into Survivor, but they can, the people who are already into Survivor and have been sticking with us every season for plural decades are very likely to get their kids at least looking at the screen, and maybe we can hook them.
Yeah, I think that it makes sense, but it's just a depressing state of affairs. It's
absolutely.
I think,
where... But in this case, unlike virtually all of the other complaints I have about the producers, I am very willing to acknowledge they are not crazy. Unlike, you know, to use an extreme example, like the Hourglass, I feel like was an extremely predictable kind of clusterfuck that should never have been attempted in the first place. And many, many, many other changes and twists and things that they've had along the way leave me thinking, what were you ever thinking was going to happen that could turn this into, like, I don't know why you would have thought this was a good idea in the first place. As things pertain to Survivor becoming much more a show for families rather than for adults, I have a hard time, frankly, faulting them for that. I at the very least see where they are coming from and why they can talk themselves into that being a very good idea.
So in that context, then, I wonder if it's maybe too simple to group all of the new era seasons together, and if 41 specifically stands out as this very unique case where they knew they were rebooting the show. It's been a while since they had to do this. They have all of the additional struggles with COVID restrictions and everything else. And on top of that, they're trying to adopt this new outlook and philosophy for the show. They're trying to bring it in line with the diversity requirement and everything else. And so the show was still going through its new era teething pains. Like, if this is a new show, effectively, well, this is the first season of that new show, and first seasons usually have some kinks that you have to work out. And so you end up with a season where there is actually like a lot of conflict. So not just Sydney, who they try to minimize as much as possible, but the entire Luwu tribe seemingly just like not having that much time for each other. And we're not quite sure how we're meant to show that, even though the entire end game is basically Luwu members. So necessarily we're leaving this gaping hole where our story is meant to be. But also you have everything that was going on with Ricard and Shan, and just Shan in general as a historically great casting choice, and also perhaps a historically messy casting choice if other reality show appearances are to be believed as well. And also the context of the Black Alliance and the fallout from that on the show, and then inevitably how that was received by social media and the narrative that the show had to try and construct around that. And like, okay, we're building a show that's for kids and for families. How are families going to process this and, you know, teach their kids about what this very like weighty moment is meant to offer? So I think that season, I think in retrospect, it's going to look like this weird historical anomaly where a lot of what we say about, well, the show doesn't have conflict these days and everything else, even though the new format for the show was like being locked into place, the tone of it is going to feel very discordant with 42 and 43 and 44 and presumably every 40 something season for the near future.
So I don't know that I'm like necessarily ruling that out of future season. I think Shan and Ricard are like perfect illustrations of home run casting choices where, on top of being captivating players that are just fun to have on your TV screen from the Survivor kind of gameplay perspective, I also think that they were like both, and not to single just the two of them out, but I think they're very good examples, both totally realistic people that you could see producing a ton of conflict over any season of Survivor that they end up playing. And I don't think the show views that as an exclusively like bad thing these days. I think under the right circumstances, they could find themselves almost happy to start exploring that side of things again. I just think the days of the Corinne asking Sugar about her dead dad, Sue Hawk and the snakes and rats and all that, like, I think those days are for the most part behind us. But I think I'd be a little more reluctant to say that it's a done deal that every season in the at least short-term future is going to have necessarily the same vibe as the last few have. I think that is more likely than not, but maybe I'm being overly optimistic here that like the range of outcomes is wider than it realistically is. But I think under the right circumstances, we could absolutely get back into at least the Shannon Ricard kind of level of spice.
I would hope so. Yeah, here's hoping there. In terms of wider discussions about this season or just where the show is at these days, I know there's a lot of the usual recriminations that the seasons feel quite samey now. So that comes across in like the format. So it's always three tribes. It's always like the sanctuary is like officially a thing now. And so instead of having some amount of variety in where the rewards are or whatever, it's just going to be the sanctuary, even minor stuff like that. Just they're kind of standardizing the show a bit more for better or for worse. And then there's things like we're in Fiji every season, which I think enough has been said about that specifically. But when you're in the same location, you get the same iconography every season. You get similar tribe names every season, too. So this just like had me in hysterics when I realized it. So I was on the Wikipedia page for Survivor 42, just like fact checking something that crossed my mind quickly. Could you tell me the tribe names from that season?
Sure couldn't.
Okay, so after an entire season here where hearing about the Tika 3, has been drummed into my skull, and I don't think I'll ever forget it, to go back to 42 and realize two of the tribes were Taku and Ika, and we just like merged those two together to create a whole new tribe name like that. It's like they really have scraped the bottom of the barrel here. I don't know how many combinations of syllables we have left to work with here. And then I will leave the remembering that third tribe name as an exercise to the listener. You know, good trivia question for years from now. But that's the kind of thing that makes it feel like just the seasons blur into each other. And as soon as one season ends, you're on to the next thing. Where, yeah, in the past with, you know, Survivor China, for example, which that's the bar high. That's a very distinct location. But you remember so many of just the stuff about the tribe camps from that season, or like we have Fei Long versus John Hu, and next season, well, we're going to have something completely different. And then we get to Gabon, and that's an entirely new, lush, amazing setting with its own kind of backdrop to it. With all of that being gone, like if the format of the game was the same, but we were going from Fiji to China to Samoa to God knows where else, going full amazing race on this thing, that at least would inject some element of variety. But it feels like any chance to inject variety is going in the other direction instead. And when everything is going in the same direction, well, that just, you know, of course, everything is going to feel like the same in the end.
So I've certainly heard a lot of grievances aired along those lines. I've, on top of that, heard people talk about how, oh, now that we're down to just using numbers instead of like season kind of themes and subtitles and so forth, that causes all of them to blend together. I think it is far more about the first thing you laid out, which is just the format is so similar every single time. And I think like in isolation, I really like the format, but when it is every single season after season after season after season, understandably, it's going to be at a certain point hard to differentiate, especially when the tribe names are all so similar. And on top of that, Dom, I think a big piece of it, at least for me, is the advantage kind of overload. And especially in the early days, there's so many different things to keep track of. And we're seeing so many of either identical the same or spiritually the same or hard to differentiate the same, a lot of very repetitive kind of advantages if they're not literally identical. And I don't think, again, much like the season format in isolation, I get why they are compelling ideas, and I certainly understand why the producers want things in the game to spice it up. But I think one of the things that makes it so difficult for any of these seasons to truly form its own kind of identity is because so much revolves around those little trinkets within the game, on top of the fact that the trinkets themselves are, at least when I was looking at the kind of rundown of who was playing what and what was successful and what went home in people's pockets and so forth, we spend so much time learning about, finding, not in that order, finding, then learning about what these advantages are, and then seeing people try to play around them. And then they are often successful at playing around them. And I think that is kind of playing a bigger role than at least I've heard addressed in terms of why a lot of this tends to feel so similar. And at least for me, again, maybe others disagree. I'm guessing some out there do. But the fact that there is no possibility of a season that is so heavily focused on advantages for so much of the time really finding its footing in any of those advantages. Now, there are, except like, I will certainly remember about this season Danny successfully playing that idol on Franny. I don't know how much else I'll remember about Danny and what went on during that like portion of the game, but I definitely will remember an idol actually successfully being played. And I think, I don't know if I'd go as far as to say that it's just like a fundamental misconception from the producers, as I would in some other respects, as things pertain to what makes advantages cool in the first place, but I do think it's kind of an uphill battle for these seasons to not have those big moments cemented by advantages, despite having so much opportunity to do so, the same way that, you know, Exile Island, a big plot point there was Terry has the idol. What are we going to do about the idol? And that's going to be like a big multi-episode arc. And then for many, many years, it was often this one idol is in the game that we need to worry about. And how are we going to get around that? And, you know, Yule having it the next season and James getting blindsided with two idols in his bag. These days, it feels like because the advantages are so diluted, it really puts a damper on the ability of any one of them to even leave like a lasting memory on me, short of like truly exceptional circumstances. And like the only one I can really think of, at least off the top of my head, from the new era is 43 when Noelle and Owen pulled that fast one on James and like used the steal a vote as like a decoy essentially to lull James into a false sense of security. That I thought was like a perfect illustration of like really outside the box and cool thinking of ways to get these new advantages to kind of work together and create a very cool kind of storyline and elimination. But I think it really does take exceptional circumstances, you know, despite the fact there are like double digit numbers of these things going in every single season. And I think that has been one of the bigger problems as far as like game design in the new era, is the like oversaturation leads to any particular advantage play being almost immediately forgettable.
And I think someone did the rundown on the first, I don't remember the exact number, but it was 7 or 8 votes of the season, just reflecting on like what was the first regular vote where there was no advantage being played or no twist or no thing which was meant to spice up what could have been a normal survivor vote. When was the first normal survivor vote? And you get to, it might actually be Joss, like at the merge, before the merge, however you want to decide it there. Like, that's a long time to wait before you actually just get to watch this fundamental part of the survivor format get to just display the faith that we put in it for the first 40 something seasons, right?
Yeah.
Or so there was also a questionnaire that some of the early jurors were able to answer, and those answers were published leading into the finale. One of the questions there was, who do you think on the jury played the best game, other than yourself, of course? And one of the universal answers there was Kane. And it was kind of funny to me that, well, it's easy to say that Kane played this amazing game when Kane at no point had to do anything that could possibly offend anyone who's on the jury there with him. So, you know, he misvotes kind of at the first vote, like he votes for Brandon, which caused a lot of blowback there. Maddie goes home, very chaotic start of the season. And then after that point, he misvotes for Jam Jam at the Josh vote. He doesn't have to participate in the map vote where you have the split tribal and the merge nonsense there. And then incorrectly votes for, or you know, votes for Franny, she gets idled, and then votes for Danny, gets voted out himself instead. And so, yeah, it's easy for you to say Kane was playing this amazing social game when at no point did the ramifications of his game involve actually voting people out. And that's a larger story about what all of these twists do to the game, where the idea of taking someone to task because they are responsible for voting you out or blindsiding you, that's much harder to do when you have just idols raining from the sky and it feels like anyone could just be expelled from the game at any moment. The idea of having to be accountable for the decisions that you make, and you know, someone leaves the game fuming because they know exactly who's responsible, like that doesn't have the same gravity to it that it did in the past. And so yeah, we're less likely to see the classic like bitter juror demanding to know why someone blindsided them, even if they were allowed to do that, which they're not really anymore, just because the game format and the game structure just doesn't really allow for it in the same way.
Yeah, and I mean, the I feel like the we've been desensitized to a ton of things because, to return to a concept I was getting at a few minutes ago, I feel like a lot of these votes, like in isolation, would be really, really interesting and leave people shocked and impressed. But when it happens so frequently, like these weirdo advantages combined with vote splits or whatever, and like, if you had told me in the dark, hey, the first person eliminated from this season is going to get eliminated with only one vote because multiple people are going to play shots in the dark and Idol's going to get played, like, that by itself is objectively like fascinating to me. And then we show up the next week and it's another crazy pre-merge tribal council where all this chaos is going on. And then the week after that, Sarah's leaving with what she thinks is a real idol and so forth. Like, someone both playing a real idol or an advantage or leaving the game with one in their pocket is now so standard that it fails to pack the same punch as when you only have a couple of things in the game. And I know I sound, I'm sure, like some person who has just had the game totally pass them by, and maybe that's exactly what I am at this point. But I, for one, while understanding how the producers talk themselves into this being a good idea, and I get that, like, Jeff wants every vote to be crazy and unpredictable, and in the old days end with hashtag blindside or hashtag wow or whatever. I understand how he talks himself into that. I think in at least a few respects, though, along those lines, we're kind of missing the forest for the trees here, where when every single week, for the most part at least, is like that, it very much minimizes the extent to which any of those votes can truly have the impact they theoretically probably deserve. And I don't think it's a coincidence at all that even though all these crazy things were happening during the early weeks this season, it's not really until we get to the later part where there is way less going on in the way of advantages that the season, as far as I could tell, really picked up in the eyes of the viewers.
Yeah, so I would say I enjoyed Danny saving Franny with the idol. That was a pretty by-the-book idol play of the sort that we've had almost 30 seasons of at this stage. And the whole, the concern as we got closer to the merge about, well, there were three real idols in the game and also three fake idols, that did not overpower things the way that I worried they might for a little bit. And there was the whole thing about, well, does Jamie know that her idol is fake or whatever? But for the most part, it wasn't as damaging as it had the potential to be, which raises a question kind of why do it, right? Like, it's almost, if you want Advantage Geddon, and Jeff has said he loves Advantage Geddon and would seek to emulate that at any opportunity, then I guess, do you count the season as a failure in that regard, that you had the ingredients there and like didn't put the recipe together? Or I don't know, but
I think any scenario that got him this Tika 3 story is going to be fine with Jeff.
Yeah, but I enjoyed the latter half of the season much more, in part because it resembled classic Survivor to the extent that the show ever does these days, and that was good. I think that the show stuck the landing in that regard. So I would like to leave the discussion of the season just as we left the season on a positive note. I think there is a lot to say about the direction the show has taken. We've said it on previous episodes, including the previous episode we did about 44. I'm sure we'll say it again if and when we come in here for 45. Anything else that you have to add at this point?
I guess I would ask you where 44 lands for you in your new era rankings.
New era rankings. So I think I would have it above 43. I remember liking 42 a lot then and now, but my memory of it is not as vivid as it was of 41, for example, which, as I said, I think history will maybe not look more cunny, but have a lot more to say about 41. And so I think I would, for now, say like 42, 41, 44, and then 43 probably as a distant fourth.
I am going, I don't know how popular this take even is. I think I am going to put 44 at the top of my new era rankings, Dominic. And honestly, I could be talked out of that. I feel bad that the podcasts we have come in here to do are often quite critical of like a lot of the production decisions. I'm giving my honest opinions. I'm not just putting this on for no real reason, but I do think it is not often a realistic representation of how much I am enjoying, for the most part, the seasons, like, as I am watching them. I just all at the same time feel like I have so much less to say episode by episode than I generally did before. Like, we over on the Patreon feed have been doing Cambodia, and we just accidentally did 100 minutes a few days ago on the Kelly Wigglesworth boot in Cambodia, because like that era and a lot of eras of Survivor, to me, I just feel like have a lot more substantive things to talk about from like a podcasting perspective compared to this era, which I feel like is largely defined by every episode is kind of its own thing, and the game now comes a lot more down to just making it to the next round where any crazy things could fall out of the sky and who knows what's going to happen. Not to completely diminish by any stretch the complex, long-term kind of social game, of course, that needs to be front of mind for the people out there. But I do feel like whenever we hang up on these podcasts, I feel bad that I was as critical about certain things as I have been, and I may end up hanging up this podcast and feeling similarly. So let me at least go out on the note of I very much enjoyed watching this season week by week, and I watched it, I would say, far more casually than I have, I think, literally any season ever. I think this is the first time in my entire Survivor viewing career that I have just, with very few exceptions, if not literally zero exceptions, I don't know that I rewatched a single episode of Survivor 44, but I definitely look forward to doing so in the future. And I would say the same about, I think, all of the seasons of the new era. Is I don't think I am even like fully appreciating myself how much I will enjoy these years from now, like on a rewatch when I can be less concerned about potentially bad production decisions and what that's going to mean for the future of the franchise if it's years from now and I don't have to worry about the future of the franchise anymore. And I think 44 in particular really is the one that stands out to me for a reason that we talked about near the top of the show, and I would like, I feel like we would be doing an injustice not to circle back on what Jam Jam brought to this season. If it wasn't clear before, Jam Jam, at the risk of letting recency bias play an outsized role in my interpretation here, I really truly don't remember the last player I enjoyed watching and rooting for to the same extent that I did Jam Jam on this season. And I think he, as the winner, and just the Tika 3 arc in general, is solidly a top half, at the very least, kind of Survivor season overall. And to me, kind of the standout narrative of the entire new era to this point. I really do feel like it is worth circling back on just how much I enjoyed watching Jam Jam and how impressed I was by the game that he ended up playing. So, Dom, I'm happy we could wrap it up on some positive notes.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't spoken much about where does Jam Jam fall in the winner rankings or whatever, but certainly as a mix of a character and a player, and just as a novelty as well, someone who bring something new to the table in a show where 44 seasons in, you'd expect most of the ways to win would have kind of been played out by now. I think, doing a quick scan in my head, I think you really have to go back to the 20s probably before you get to that latter era, like Tony into Natalie Anderson sequence, before you get anyone who has that same blend of, you know, character, personality, gameplay, and so on. He is a refreshing breath of fresh air, I suppose, in that regard. I'm losing my ability to construct sentences, which I think is a sign that we need to get ourselves out of here. But to leave it on that happy note, I think Jam Jam is the right winner for the season and just a great winner for the franchise to have overall. And very glad that he gets to be the show's reigning ambassador, at least for a few more months.
Yeah, and as for the question of where Jam Jam falls in my, like, all-time winner rankings, I certainly do not know the exact number or percentile or whatever. Suffice to say, high. I am super, super high on Jam Jam as just a Survivor player in general. I think that dude is tailor-made to just crush a game like this. Okay, so Dom, great times. It does appear that we're going to have at least one familiar face coming up on Survivor 45. If you remember Bruce, if that name rings a bell. Hey, Survivor Twitter's own Brandon Donlan, it sounds like, going to be on Survivor 45. So I have to imagine we'll at least be checking in from time to time whenever that rolls around. In the meantime, we are, as mentioned, covering Cambodia currently over on the patron feed at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. And Dom, I think let's actually do this now this time instead of just saying it. Now that it is the official Survivor off season, we will get our minds together on what to unlock from some old season we did a while ago on the patron feed, because it really does bother me that we were putting out so little Survivor content on the main feed. So something we covered years and years ago on the patron feed. I think the Survivor offseason is a good time to just kind of slowly release that. And then we will see what else we have in store for the offseason. Until then, though, Dom, anything else that you feel like we need to get to today?
No, I think we covered everything. We'll definitely be back in here during the offseason with non-Survivor stuff, I suppose, which means it's not the offseason, it's just the season, but so it goes.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll have stuff coming up in hopefully not too long. Until then, he is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am on Twitter at Colin Stone. One more time, if you would be interested in hearing the, at this point, many, many, many hours of bonus content over on the patron feed, patreon.com/Dom and Colin. But until whenever it is that we are back here on the main feed, that is going to do it for us here today. Thank you all, of course, as usual. Whoever has made it this far, you're doing the Lord's work. We will talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.